have taken a wrong turn. When will I learn? When will I learn? Should I show them all my scars? Cherry red, bleeding burn. Like an angry apple tree, I throw my apples if you get too close to me. But if I look to my right, well, I see the one I fight for. If I look to my right.
This is Comics Therapy, episode 34. No reviews, just analysis. Up this week, two comics from March 12th, 2014, Astro City number 10 and East of West number 10. As always, we have your nerd confessions, and on the couch, we welcome writer Matt D. Wilson. Just as a reminder, we never do reviews, but we do talk a lot, so there may be spoilers from here on out.
Hi, this is Cameron Williams, Wasgo from Twitter, and I'm recording a nerd confession on behalf of Chris, Unlikely Nerd from Twitter. His confession is: the only way I listen to any advice concerning comics is via word of mouth, usually from people I talk to on a consistent basis on Twitter. If a book is good, you'll see consistent remarks saying so. Same if it's garbage. If I ask people I trust for recommendations, I'll usually get a consistent yay or nay, except on New Warriors. That's a different story for a different time zone. And the main thing Chris wants to get across is that he primarily takes my advice. Now, New Warriors was a rare exception, but I can't be blamed for that. To be honest, it was his first time reading digital, and, well, basically I just refuse to admit I'm wrong. Anyway, have a great day, and I only trust Aaron.
Welcome to Comics Therapy. Neither Aaron nor I are licensed therapists, so don't take anything we say seriously. We've got trust issues this week, and for once, I'm not just talking about Aaron and I. We're looking at a few dangerous characters making shady choices to stay alive, who'd stab you in the back as they whispered sweet nothings in your ear. We've also got a great example of one of my personal favorite character types, the unreliable narrator. So unreliable, he's not even in this month's issue. So who can you really trust these days anyway?
Who do I trust when it comes to indie comics? The creators. I chat them up to find out what the book is about, and if it's up my alley, I have a pretty established list of characters that I follow, unless I hear that a particular creator ruined that character. I also trust the comic shop I order from. Sarah knows me well enough to know that if I'm going to hate a new book or not. And there are some creators that I've disliked and still read because I like what they're doing with the story. So yeah, I'm complicated, I know.
I don't know.
That's it?
Oh, was that?
That's your comment?
Yeah, I don't know.
Okay, carry on.
Was I supposed to think about this? Was I supposed to come up with a name?
No, you're supposed to read the script.
Hello, this is Patton Cummings, and I'm here to answer the question of what do you trust when buying comic books? Creators, characters, publishers, word of mouth? I would have to say it's like all of the above. I mean, I know that's a cop-out, and I have my very particulars, and there's no rhyme or reason to why I enjoy what I do. I'm just you know, weird like that. But creators-wise, you know, you have your favorite creators. You know, mine's Mr. Bendis and Hickman and so on. The list goes on and on. Character-wise, you know, I love the giant Batmans and the Supermans and the Captain Americas, blah, 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 and the lower guys. There's some lower guys that I love. Luke Cage, Squirrel Girl. I don't know why, but I love Squirrel Girl. Publishers, I really love Oni Press books. I think they do a really good job, and they're awesome. And last but not least, there's plenty of books where I'm like, that could be good, but I just don't want to take the risk, so I'll wait for it to come out and see what people have to say about it, you know, see how many people say it's awesome. So, I mean, really, it is all the above. Later, guys.
In between comic segments, your very own nerd confessions, celebrating the geeky things we all do, say, read, and enjoy. This week we asked who you trust to make suggestions about new comics. Do you believe everything publishers tell you, or are you more likely to follow word of mouth? Do you trust creators, or are you true to characters? You can call, Skype, or email your confessions. All the details are on the website, comicstherapy.com. Remember, catharsis is cool.
Yes, this is Joshua Seltzer, and I am on the Twitter handle Gamma Mantium. I would like to say, in response to the question, who do you trust when you're picking your comics? I replied on the Twitter that I actually like creative teams like Bendis and Maleev, or, you know, Chris Claremont, and, you know, just different people. Lee and Ditko. But, you know, in confession, they all have a bad day, and sometimes they even fail you. So I just think you should go with your gut. And that's what I wanted to say. Thank you.
In between shows, you can find me on Twitter at Andrea Schock and Aaron at Aaron Myers, and the show account at Comics Therapy. So Aaron, who do you trust?
I've given this a lot of thought since the last time you asked me.
Which was about a minute ago?
I don't think even that long. But I think very quickly. I trust myself.
Of course. You do read all the comics.
I read many comics. Okay. So I think that gives me a pretty decent basis for kind of parsing out who I like, who I don't like, who I want to see. I think also we are as part of the inner circle.
Oh, fuck.
We get access to books ahead of time. So I think that helps us make some decisions that most, you know, like the people on the outside, the waste. You know, to use a Lazarus term.
I can't even believe you did that as a joke. So what were you actually going to say?
That's part of a way I can make a decision. So that's not really fair in a general sense. But I guess in terms of what people look for, and I don't think I'm one of those people, but there are people that do a good job of this, of their kind of reviews, analysis, and recommendations of books that are coming out when you get advanced reviews. Okay. You have to trust people who have similar tastes to you, because there are really good, smart reviewers and writers that like books that I don't like. So, right. So it's not that I'm not going to trust their opinion. I just know their tastes are way different than anything I'm into.
Okay.
So for me, I follow creators more than I do publishers or characters. Not to say that if they came out with a ROM comic book, I don't care who it was written by, I'd still buy it, you know?
Sure.
But, you know, it's people whose tastes are similar to mine and myself, and that's it. And creators. So if there's a creator I really like, say, like, you know, Rick Remender's coming out with a new book, I'm going to pick it up because I like what he does.
No matter what, you'll try it.
I'll try it, yeah. What about you?
I guess I don't have that different of an answer. I think word of mouth is very important, but I think your caveat that you have to know who to listen to is important. For me, I have a short list of people who know me well enough to know my tastes to make personal recommendations. So mm-hmm. It's less about me knowing the specific tastes of critic or another writer. And instead, it's the other way around. It's like that list of people who I trust enough to make a recommendation to me because they know what I do and don't like.
Yeah, but at the same time, like, I've recommended books to you that you would probably not like, if that makes sense. Or, you know, you would be quick to say, I don't like those kind of books.
You're making an assumption that you're on my list.
Oh, I'm definitely on your list.
Oh, are you?
Yeah, you read everything I tell you to read.
You do not make recommendations of things that you know that I'm not going to like just to be a dick, though.
No, but I know you think you won't like them until you read them, and then you like them.
Point being what? The Walking Dead? Is that going to be, like, your trump card no matter what?
No, I think that's a fine example. I'm trying to think. I know there were other things that I don't think you would have thought you would like that you
I wouldn't
ended
have
up
picked
liking.
Up Bedlam, probably, if we hadn't decided.
Yeah, that's,
a, that
that's
we were
another good one.
It.
Uh-huh.
That's a decent example.
Yeah, I know there's probably dozens of other ones too.
Dozens, at least 30, 70, over 100 titles that I owe all to you. Thank you, Aaron Myers.
You're welcome.
There's this perception, I don't know if you're aware of this, that I don't actually read comics.
That is not a perception, that is a fact.
It is not. That's totally bullshit.
By your own admission.
But it's a joke.
Every joke has a huge outer layer and inner kernel of truth in your case.
Like inner circle? Anyone?
No. Well,
you don't actually believe any of the inner circle stuff, for example. That's totally a joke, and you know it.
I think the term is a joke. I don't think we're like special or anything like that. But I think there is a fact that because we do this show and occasionally write reviews and do columns for sites, that we have access to, review material that not everyone has access to.
That's a true fact, but almost anybody could get that access. And so what I'm saying is that you're making a joke when you use that term, and I know that, and hopefully now everybody else knows that it's not that you actually believe in any kind of entitlement or
no, of course not.
Right, because you're a huge dork, and that's another thing we all know.
But at the same time, if people don't get that humor, they're not going to listen to the show anymore. I mean, when I first made that joke, I was kind of surprised that a couple people cut ties with me.
That was a sad thing.
Kind of. I'm not really that sad about it, though. Because if somebody doesn't understand that humor and really thought that's what I believe, then they're probably not somebody I need really in my inner circle.
But by the same token, if people don't understand that I'm kidding if I say I don't read comics...
Well, obviously, we're doing a comic book podcast where we talk about comics.
Right.
But, how many comics... Okay, that's a good question. How many comics does a person have to read to be a comic reader?
Oh, man. That's a yucky question. Because that implies some kind of hierarchy, that if you're only reading 2 or 3 books a week, that you're not as good as somebody who's reading 30 books a week.
And I don't think that's true at all, but I think it's good to kind of put it out there, because there's sort of... There is that implication a lot of times.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, for a myriad of reasons, like time and money, most people can't read 30 books a week.
Right.
I mean, that's ridiculous. But we also have such an enthusiastic group, especially with Twitter and Facebook, social media, of, you should read this book. Oh, you got to read this book. You got to read this book. If we all took each other's suggestions and read all the great books out there,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I would read 70 titles a week, because there's a lot of good comics out there.
Right.
You just can't read them all.
True. But I read a lot more books every week than we just talk about on the show.
Yeah. Even if all you read was what we talk about on the show, that's still a pretty decent amount of reading material.
Yeah, and there are weeks like this one where I read East of West regularly and I don't read Astro City. So for you, Aaron, because you made that recommendation to me, I caught up on that. But East of West was just a matter of reading this particular issue.
Right, but you had to read 10 issues of Astro City.
Just for you.
That's a lot of comics.
It is. But mm-hmm. then all of the rest of the books that are out this week that I read regularly, I'll read between, say, Tuesday night and Sunday or so.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes... it takes me a little bit longer to get caught up, and sometimes it doesn't. I guess I'm a little defensive.
That's reading all. For pleasure. I read for pleasure too, but part of my Wednesday is also sharing all the stuff that I like with people. That's yeah. part of my reading experience. So
right.
I want to get as much read by Wednesday as possible.
Right.
But that's not realistic or maybe even fun for most people.
No.
Yeah, so everyone just enjoy the stuff you enjoy and... check out stuff you want to check out, and you don't have to worry about what inner circle you're part of. You're all part of one inner circle or another. There's plenty of circles.
Right. Time is a flat circle, as a matter of fact.
That's right. You're interested what?
I'm interested to hear what everybody's response was to this prompt, because I've only heard two.
Mm-hmm.
And I listened to Keith Silva's, which was hilarious and was also very complete in that he covered more bases than I expect a lot of listeners to have. I think that it's more common to have one or two people that you talk to about specific recommendations and then kind of a longer list of other people that you talk about comics with. But maybe I'm wrong. That's what I'm intrigued to find out.
Yeah. Well, it's a journey we will all go on during the show.
Mostly me, because I'll be the one who edits it together.
Right, and I'll have heard them by that point.
Right.
Well, everyone else will go on the journey. We've already been on it.
Anything else from this week?
It's sunny here in Eugene. That's nice to have sun.
Can we talk about True Detective?
Sure. I don't want to give spoilers for people, because I think a lot of people have not watched it.
I don't know what they could possibly be doing with their lives if they weren't watching it.
Who knows? Roxy got acupuncture this week.
Oh, that's right. I saw the pictures.
Dog acupuncture? She's living a better life than I am?
How's that working out for her?
I don't know. She seems fine.
Her chi is
in alignment.
Was it a pain management thing?
No, it's just supposed to kind of help keep the body in balance, and I don't know. If it helps, it helps.
Cool.
That's like, really, the vet says some dogs, it doesn't seem to really do much. Some, they get lots of energy, and some will kind of sleep the first few treatments. Like, they'll sleep for a day, you know, it really, like, puts their body into a very much more restful state, and some, it just doesn't do much, so we kind of do four sessions and then see if it makes any difference for her. And if so, we continue. If not, we just, you know, we don't.
Okay.
Yeah, why not? Acupuncture seems cool.
I don't know anything about it. I've never had acupuncture.
Me either. It's just little needles at different points in the body.
Just a thing you're willing to do to demonstrate your love for your dog. And that's awesome.
For a family member and companion.
That's right.
So let's talk about some comics.
Okay.
The snow glows white on the mountain tonight, not a footprint to be seen. A kingdom of isolation, and it looks like I'm the queen.
How's it going, fellow fork and spoon operators of the Comics Therapy Podcast? I'm Keith Silva. Trust, huh? I was promised a True Detective prompt this week. Oh well, I rocked my answer for the Two-Headed Nerd Answer of the Week this week. So this one should go down as easy as a sixer of Lone Star. I don't want to invoke Image Comics publisher Eric Stevenson's recent locker room speech as industry invective, other than to say, as long as we keep buying our comics in boutique shops and not Target and Walmart, which according to Stevenson shouldn't ever be the comic buyer's milieu, we wouldn't want to, you know, have more people reading comics after all. So we're okay. When it comes to suggestions for comics, the people I trust, first and foremost, are my local LCS gurus. I'm not talking about the Flavor of the Week comic. I'm talking about every comic, from every age, and for all ages. Somewhere, customer service went from helpful to invasive. I trust my local comic shop, Earth Prime Comics in Burlington, because they want to talk about comics. All comics, no matter what kind. There's no mandate from management. It's authentic. I also wanted to mention a great experience I had at a New England Comics in Massachusetts a couple months back. A woman, you can't see it in my script, but there are 3 exclamation points behind the word woman. She was, in the parlance of that region, wicked smart when it came to comics. Anyhow, she was generally disappointed when her store was sold out of the hardcover edition of Hawkeye that I was looking to buy. She asked if she could order it for me or get it from another one of their stores. That's what we in the service industry refer to as Check Plus Service. So trust your local comic book shop guys and gals. They know how to do things. And if you need more, there's Jason Sachs, Daniel Elkin, Taylor Lilly, and the rest of the writers at Comics Bulletin. There's podcasts like The Two-Headed Nerd, Panel Culture, and Orbital Comics. Also a shout out to my brothers from other mothers and fathers, my Scotch buddies, Victor Von Zoom and Charles Russell. Oh, and there's these other two, Aaron and Andrea. They have some kind of non-True Detective podcast. It's about couches or feelings about couches. Doesn't matter. They ignore the callers. It's their show, so it's all about them. So, whatever. Silva, out.
Our first book this week is Astro City number 10, written by Kurt Busiek, with art by Brent Anderson, colors by Alex Sinclair. Am I doing that right? That's about how you do it, yeah?
Yeah, I see what you're doing. Go on.
And lettering by Comic Craft. Astro City is published by Vertigo Comics. So, Aaron, tell the nice people at home about this book because, as I mentioned, it was new to me this week.
Let's see. How does Andrea recap things? I didn't recap it, but let's see. Basically, this book is about... Is that how you would do it?
Dick.
Let's see. Astro City is about Astro City and the people and the heroes that live in it. It is, I would say it's a slice of life book based around the either simple people that live there or the superheroes. I mean, that's what it's about.
The inner or outer circle, as it were.
Inner or outer circle.
Right.
This Vertigo series is a relaunch after a hiatus of the ongoing series that's, I guess it's been 10 years total, you know, with
something
breaks.
Like that, yeah.
So I didn't make you read it from the beginning because the relaunch is a good jumping on point. But I think it also is good for the people that have been reading it since the beginning or caught up, you know, from the beginning or just jumped on here.
So can I ask some questions?
Sure.
Because one of the things that I find the most appealing that isn't in this issue and hasn't been in the past three issues, because this arc is very much playing it straight, and I'm kind of over that.
Okay.
What I like about the earlier issues is this breaking of the fourth wall, unreliable narrator who we've established is likely a patient in a mental facility, and it's not necessarily clear how much is in his head and how much is not. And I think that playing with that reality and playing with that breaking of the wall is really fun and not often done successfully in comics.
Maybe. That's the part I like the least.
This is why we make a good team, because sometimes I'm right and sometimes you're not.
Yeah, that would not be one of the times right now.
Fair enough.
I like the slice of life stories about somebody who works in the, you know, superhero kind of dispatch center.
That was cool. That was a good series.
Yeah.
Or I guess it was like two issues.
Yeah.
Right? But was that the way that this title was dealt with before?
I've only read the early volume before coming to this. So I don't know as the series goes on. I believe it's still sticking to the same format.
Okay. Because I felt like that introductory character, the mental patient, the narrator who is both omniscient and yet protective of his knowledge,
mm-hmm.
was a really exciting way to introduce me to the slice of life stories. So it was almost like there was a curator there making decisions about what I could and couldn't have access to. And that was like a nifty little convention there that's been missing without explanation over the past, what is it, three issues of this current arc.
Mm-hmm.
So the tone shift is a little bit jarring. This is very heavy-handed, what's happening right now. We've got this kind of male versus female domination storyline with the, can I assume that it's a stand-in-ish for like a Superman, Wonder Woman
yeah.
type
so,
character?
So one thing I guess I should have put into the recap is Astro City is Busick's homage to the Silver Age.
Right.
So all of this, yes, like the Samaritan is Superman.
Sure.
Yeah, so they are allegories for classic superheroes.
But these past several issues, very, very heavy-handed with the, like, women's liberation front.
Mm-hmm. Sure. But it's also a character having to, it's that stripped down of a character. Like, it's not a new story. It's just that story being told differently, you know, with a new character of being stripped of everything, having to find out who's done it and find the strength within themselves to, you know, rise again.
Got it. That's fine.
Yeah. I mean, that's a very classic kind of, you know, superhero story arc.
Absolutely. But what would have been more interesting to me is if it was told with the perspective of, I'm not entirely sure how much of this I can believe as it's being presented.
No, that's weird. I think because I read them spaced out. I've been reading them month to month. Like, I'm not even really thinking about that first, you know, introductory character.
He's been back a bunch.
Yeah, it just, it's, it didn't seem to matter in this story. And that's it. Well, I also kind of know the structure. Well, yeah, but the structure of this book works that way often.
This is the first time that there have been three issues where he hasn't appeared.
Yes, I know. But what I'm saying is in prior volumes.
Okay.
There are like bigger stories that will go on for, you know, five or six issues or something like that. And then get back to one-offs and then come back to larger stories.
I think that was a touchstone for me to see, I don't know, I guess to kind of build up some skepticism about how Astro City works, like, as a whole, mm-hmm. right? So you have the dispatcher and you have this alien presence with the door.
Yeah.
And we've seen how that is now affecting the citizens of Astro City. And yet we're kind of questioning how much of that we're privy to mm-hmm. yet. But we've now shifted gears and gone back to dealing with the, like, traditional heroes exclusively for the past several issues. And, like, honestly, just from reading it as a whole chunk, all 10 issues, these last three were a little bit dull because they were missing, for me, what was a hook as something that set it apart from a more traditional homage to, like, Silver Age stories. Like, those are kind of a dime a dozen.
Yeah, I think that is a fair criticism.
I'm not necessarily sure that it's a criticism. It's an observation, and it's absolutely colored by my personal preference. I think unreliable narrators are kind of the bee's knees, and they're not often done well in comics.
But why do you like an unreliable narrator? I want to know the story I'm reading is the story I'm reading.
Because, oh man, I don't think I can do this without referencing True Detective. I think that that's the secret for the entire episode, Aaron, is that I'm going to just talk about that instead of, you know, it's like the new Hawkeye. Everything that I talk about is going to reference True Detective.
Okay,
think about
fine.
How interesting it is to find out that the story that you have believed flips and actually it's one-sided or it's missing huge gaps or it was presented to you to convince you of one thing when the reality is different. As a storytelling device, that's very sophisticated and very interesting to me. As opposed to just a straightforward, even like dramatic irony type of situation.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think the weight you're putting onto it just doesn't carry with me. Like, if it works to carry the story, that's fine. Like, if it hooks me in, that's fine. If not, that's fine too. I also don't want it to go on too long to where the whole universe, the whole story is thrown into question. Like, I don't want a Hill Street Blues kind of situation where at the end it's a autistic boy's, you know, waking dream or something.
That was Saint Elsewhere, but thanks for playing.
Oh, it was close.
Not really.
Still, good 70s cop references.
That was 80s, but thanks for playing.
Oh my god, I was just showing everyone how
Elsewhere
old...
was set in a hospital, not in
Are you
a...
telling me there weren't police in that show?
They weren't the main thrust of the show.
Weren't
yeah, that's exactly
they?
What I'm telling
weren't
you.
They? Didn't I
no.
just... I just blew your mind.
Yeah, because you're wrong.
Now you're going to have to go back and watch every episode.
No, I'm going to go back and watch every episode of True Detective.
All right, well, how about we talk about something different then?
This is Tom Barnett calling in for the question of the week. Photo 10 on Twitter's. Who do we trust? Who do I trust? Certainly there's some creators that I trust that I will, if I see their name on something, I'll immediately drop down my money. That doesn't always mean that it's going to be great, but at least they get a shot. Characters? I don't really look for the characters so much, just more the creators, more, you know, knowing you're going to get a good story and good art. Publishers, I don't trust the publishers. They're going to build up their product. They want to make the money. You know, it's a heads up, but it's not really a trust. And word of mouth, though. Word of mouth, I do trust probably more than publishers or even characters, but not as much as creators' names. But word of mouth helps you find those new creators and new titles that maybe you will enjoy. Not always, but sometimes. And that's what Twitter is really great for, is finding out some of those things that you might have missed. So there's my confession. Thanks, guys.
Our second book is East of West, number 10, written by Jonathan Hickman. Art is by Nick Dragota, with colors by Frank Martin, and lettering by Russ Wooten. East of West is published by Image Comics.
You do yourself no favors when you read it like a robot.
No, those were affirmative and correct.
Pronunciation is the word you're looking for.
Yes, pronunciations. Those were affirmations, not questions.
Got it. So East of West is, of course, a remarkable sci-fi western about the end of the world. It's the story of the four horsemen of the apocalypse, except now there are three. It's the story of death, except now he's in love. It's set in a future world, a North America made up of seven distinct nations, each with a representative, one of the chosen, who believes in the message, a prophecy foretelling how the world will die. It's gory as hell, it's dense, and it's beautiful, and it's clever, and it's one of my favorite books because I actually read comics. I've been waiting for a while to talk about this. Every character has his or her own motive, and not a single one of them can be trusted, and it's awesome.
Yes. Yeah, and yeah, I agree. So let's move on. No, I'm kidding.
Really?
No. This is one of my favorite books, too, and it drives me crazy when people say how it needs to be read, collected, or there's too much going on, they can't keep track of it. To me, it's like, God, I don't know. I guess I can't talk clearly about, you know, Hickman stuff. Because I love that, those slow burns and, like, getting little pieces of the story month by month.
This didn't ever bother me in terms of Hickman. You know that it took me a long time to come on board with transitioning to Hickman for the Avengers. Mm-hmm. So I think that there's something about the complexity of this story and the genre that lends itself to Hickman's, like, writing preferences.
Sure, yeah. And there's full control there.
Yeah.
I am not...
There's no baggage about the way that characters have been dealt with in the past?
No, well, that's a different discussion, too, because I think in some ways that baggage can force for some pretty interesting storytelling, especially okay. the way, like, Remender or Hickman, like, seem to execute it. Like, it can either be a crutch or it can be a something good.
So, future episode about baggage.
Write it down.
Got it.
But in this case, the complexity of the story, this world, this, you know, other world that never happened or has yet to happen is fascinating to me. Like, mm-hmm. the structure is enough for there that my imagination goes wild while I'm reading it. Mm-hmm. And the reliance on, like, our mythology and kind of drawing upon that is great. The story doesn't feel like it's... So this goes back to that unreliable narrator. Like, I don't think we're getting a skewed sense of the world. We're just not getting complete senses of the world.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that every time it's revealed that a character cannot be trusted, it's because of that character's actions as opposed to being foretold that, that that's what we could expect. I mean, with the exception of some of the reveals about relationships, like when you discover that there is an alliance, then you might anticipate a character's behavior choice to be in line with that alliance. But other than that, I think, yeah, I agree that we're getting bits and pieces of how that the whole story fits together.
Yeah.
But we're getting an accurate version of the story as the pieces are revealed. It's just that there are so many motives, mm-hmm. and there are so many, well, I guess there's two sort of opposing viewpoints in approaching the end of the world,
mm-hmm.
and the role of the message, and I guess kind of fate versus free will.
Yeah.
When you're talking about something as epic as the end of the world. And so that is awesome. The idea that you would not want to work against the end of the world. I don't know. Be really interesting.
Well, there's always that in mythology and spirituality and religion. There's always this sort of the end times and the harbingers of the end times and those who would bring it about, you know. And sometimes it's because of sin and greed and vice, and sometimes there's incentive, and it's always kind of fascinating what the incentives are.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this kind of draws upon this.
A couple of times that characters have acknowledged the appeal of power,
right.
as their motivator, that it's like actually kind of comfortable to have all of the power that you want and all of the comfort that comes along with that power. And so, like, why would you want to end it when the entire world burns?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it happens in real life too. Like, you have CEOs of companies making decisions that will make them money at the sacrifice of, you know, the environment and people's lives and jobs and everything right. else, because you're so far above the consequences that it doesn't matter to you.
But even in that case, you can't do it openly. And so, just to bring it back to this notion of trust, there's a juxtaposition of the kind of openness that Death is pursuing his motives. Just fucking kill everybody and, like, don't even hide it. And, like, let's get this list and we're going to go 1, 2, 3 down this list and just take care of it all because here's what my goal is. As opposed to the more, like, wheelings and dealings and, like, the back room alliances that have to come about with the Chosen who are not necessarily buying into the, like, the message any longer.
Mm-hmm.
And what the result is with the way that they interact with the horsemen. I mean, that's the part that I find so fascinating, is like the gameplay at stake with all of the different factions.
Yes.
It's pretty awesome.
It is. I agree. Everyone should be reading it.
there's not a lot that I can offer analytically because, you know, it's one of those few books that I'm cool with not being objective on. Nobody's paying me to write about it, so I don't need to be. I can just foam at the mouth and say, this is a beautiful book.
I will be frothing right there next to you.
Gross. Don't do that.
Well, I will do it through the internet.
I don't know.
Not better? Better.
Not better.
Not good, but better.
I guess. Yes. Slightly. But it's a good, I think, dovetail to the conversation that we had with Matt Wilson about conflict of interest when you're talking about books and why you need to be objective as a reviewer, as a analyzer, as a creator. So I'm just putting my cards down on the table. I don't need to be objective about this book. It's just really fucking good.
I agree. And so is our interview with Matt D. Wilson.
Thanks for reinforcing my segue.
You're welcome.
We make a good team, Aaron Myers.
Sometimes.
Yeah, you're still a dick.
Thank you. And good night.
Comics for characters. Creators and then characters. Sometimes creators can span the void from character to character, book to book. Sometimes, well, they can't. Don't worry, I'm not going to name names. For the most part, I stick to a few select creators for my, quote, I have to read that type books. Now, the rest, the, quote, I care less about books, it doesn't really matter who did it, what it's about, which characters are involved. I'm pretty easy to entertain, so I can find the good in just about anything. Oh, and if you're wondering who I believe are the, quote, rock star creators out there that I would read no matter what, well, here's my top three. Matt Tynes, Rob Gilroy, Scotty Young. Publishers, or word of mouth? I filter by publisher first, Dark Horse, Image, and Valiant. Then I go for what others think. These days, quote, word of mouth means, quote, the internet. Reviews, podcasts, tweets, blogs. You can get an opinion on anything, which can be good and bad. As I stated, I usually stick to specific creators for the, quote, important books, and then, quote, word of mouth for the rest. But I always filter by publisher. BTW, Marvel used to be on that list, but then they started throwing around terms like, quote, all new, and now, quote, in caps. Yeah. Well, that was fun. Charles at Danos Rules.
This week on The Couch, we welcome writer Matt D. Wilson. Matt co-hosts the War Rocket Ajax podcast with Chris Sims, who we spoke to back in episode 28. Under the pseudonym King Oblivion PhD, Matt wrote the Supervillain Handbook and the Supervillain Field Manual. He writes Copernicus Jones Robot Detective, published by Monkey Brain Comics. He's also contributed to the AV Club, Cracked.com, and McSweeney's.com. So, Matt, we're really expecting you to be funny today. So, as a professional, it's all on you. I hope that's fine.
I am only funny for pay. I apologize.
Damn it. Show's over. We're done.
We pay in Bitcoin, but only stolen Bitcoins. If you accept that.
You pay in the Bitcoin that lost all its value this week?
Yes.
Yeah. I can't wait for that.
Yeah.
Hey, hang on to those. It's like 90s baseball cards. One of these days, it's going to be worth something.
It's not even as good as like Confederate money, because like at least Confederate money, there's like a historical thing that you can look at. It's worthless, but you know, it's a piece of history.
Well,
Bitcoin
is
digital. Yeah, I guess you could.
you print it out on your dot matrix printer. You have reams and reams of that.
You're constantly tearing off the edges with holes in them.
So the Bitcoin check is in the mail.
Oh, good.
Yes.
Yes, we actually print out and mail the digital money. You have to then hand type it back in. It's a process, but it's worth it.
To actually acquire your money or cash it in, you've actually got to take the printouts to your computer and type in all the zeros and ones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, for an additional fee, we can put it on punch card for you.
Now that we've completely alienated the entirety of the audience that has no idea what we're talking about, either punch card or Bitcoin related, let's move on.
All right. The second issue of Copernicus Jones is out this week. So this is your first published work as a comics creator. And
that's true.
Yeah. After years of writing about the industry in other forms, do you have more comics writing projects in the works that you want to tell us about? Anything else you want to announce before we get into?
Nothing that has sort of gelled into a full-on project. I've got lots of pitches and I've got a couple of scripts for other things that could materialize into something later. But at the moment, I'm really just trying to focus on Copernicus and make it Copernicus Jones and make it sort of the best first volley that I can make it.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a really conceptual thing if people aren't familiar with it or haven't heard of it. It's basically, I mean, it's kind of what the title says. It's about a robot who's a detective. But the overarching concept of it is this idea of if you remember cartoons and old movies and stuff from the 40s, there was a time when there was a lot of world of the future kinds of displays and just discussion. Futurama, before it was a cartoon, was a word for one of those.
Well, one of my strongest like childhood memories is was it called World of the Future? The ride at Disneyland?
I think that was what was called Futurama.
Oh, maybe.
I thought that was Futureland.
Something like that.
Or maybe that's right.
I was four years old when we went to Disneyland, but like I remember the ride and it being so weird. You know, like, well, obviously that future that ride had started with, you know, had come and passed in terms of time that they were talking about. But it also seems so like surreally... Now, hopeful and kind of and twisted in a way.
Yeah, now that I think about it, I think it was called Tomorrowland.
Oh yeah, okay. Yeah, definitely.
And when I first started writing Copernicus Jones, I called his city Tomorrow City, and it was only after I saw something else had been called Tomorrow City, so I decided to call it Future City instead, which I'm sure Future City's been used somewhere else too, but it's more generic.
The future isn't written yet, though. You can't copyright the future yet.
That's right. I had a similar experience going to Disney World in Florida,
mm-hmm.
Going to Epcot Center, which is more than just kind of stuff of the future, but it had some of that in there too.
And also Figment.
But what really got me interested in that concept from the beginning was, I don't know if you remember these old Tex Avery cartoons that I think they were MGM cartoons after he left Warner Brothers, where it was just all this stuff about like the car of the future or the house of the future.
Mm-hmm.
And then later I saw all this stuff about, you know, these actual displays that were so popular in the 40s. And a lot of that stuff was about how the home or the city or whatever was going to be highly automated, mm-hmm. and that robots or mechanical things were going to be a big part of life in the future. So the idea of Copernicus Jones is, if that future actually came to pass and then got just by lack of maintenance, or just by virtue of the fact that this is what happens to things, it got kind of grimy and run down.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It just kind of became normal and then went from being this bright, sparkling future to being kind of just...
So sort of like the Jetsons meets Blade Runner?
Yes, yeah, sort of. And then the notion that robots, like these servant robots, would have to kind of fight to assert their place as actual citizens. And all of that's happening in the background. Like, none of that is part of the actual story. There's not going to be a storyline where it's like robots fighting for rights.
Uh-huh.
But at some point along the line, they became citizens or autonomous to the point where they have jobs that they choose for themselves, or at least some of them.
Yeah, but so, I noticed that they're definitely the background jobs, right? We've got yeah. robot bookie, we've got robot PI, even robot police officers, but they're all in like service-oriented positions.
Well, there's still a level of prejudice,
sure.
against mm-hmm. robots, sure. so that the ones that actually have any power, and you'll see. There's one that is in issue two, who you see a little bit of. They turn to crime,
mm-hmm.
like something like being a bookie. Yeah, like you do. like the mob, the quote unquote mob in Copernicus Jones is all robots.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually called the M period, O period, B period.
What does it stand for?
It's the Mechanical Operating Brotherhood.
Because I noticed that in the that's in issue two, right, where the acronym is revealed, but not yeah. the meaning behind it. So
yeah, it's I don't know if I'm ever actually going to spell it out in the book. I kind of just want to let people figure it out for themselves.
Well, but, thanks.
Yeah, but exclusive. but that's what it is. Like all the leaders in the mob are robots. There are underlings who are humans. Who are kind of humans who are completely down on their luck. Nice. Like there's a couple of goons who show up who are just human guys who, by all indications, are very dumb guys. but like it's sort of that, it's a combination of classic noir tropes kind of thrown into that world of the future idea. So there's, it's noir, but there's all this kind of societal stuff about robots in there. So back to your question about, other projects I've got going, I kind of just want to establish Copernicus Jones as this concept and make it work and kind of get a good groundwork laid for it before I get out there and start pitching these other ideas and having to divide my attention.
Sure, yeah.
Because I really want to keep focused on this until before... Not to mention the fact that I've got podcasts I'm doing and Comics Alliance and maybe another villain book if I can ever find time for that. So it's not like I'm right. completely – I don't have other projects going on. But as far as comics go, I really want to invest as much as I can in Copernicus to make it as kind of pure and worthwhile as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that it's hilarious. I'm a big fan of subtle parody,
but yeah.
this is honestly, it's almost like a love letter to the genre at the same time. So there's a lot of balance, I think, that you've had to strike between poking fun, but in a kind of sweet, adoring way. Did you hit on that form from the very beginning, or did the tone of the book and the, I guess, more the tone of the narration shift as you got to know the character better?
It kind of became, to answer your, well, in a word, no, I did not start that way. It did okay. not start that way at all, because my plan from the get-go was to do, I don't know if broad is the right word, but sort of more obvious parody.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I've always been into noir,
mm-hmm.
but my introduction to noir as a genre when I was a kid was from parody, was from the 80s was this crazy time of a lot of noir parody existing or just being made.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to like Who Framed Roger Rabbit,
mm-hmm.
there was, I'm trying to remember when Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid was made, which is a Steve Martin noir parody movie.
I think that's like mid-80s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would have been in the 80s, I think. Another thing from the 80s that really even introduced me to noir as a genre at all was this Jim Henson project called Dog City.
Hmm.
There was a one-season series on ABC in the late 80s called The Jim Henson Hour.
Yeah.
And it was really just a showcase for whatever the Henson Company wanted to put on TV that week.
Mm-hmm.
Like a lot of behind the scenes stuff and stuff like that. But occasionally they would do these episodes where it was just like, here's a one-off project that we don't really know what else to do with for 1 week. And 1 week they did, what they showed was this thing called Dog City, which was pretty much divorced from the Muppets entirely, except that Ralph was in it as a piano player.
Right.
he's the walk-on like connection, where they say.
Yeah, he's the connecting force between Dog City and the Muppets.
Uh-huh.
What, like at a smoky pub? There he is in the corner.
Pretty much, like awesome. There's a bar that is like the main literal watering hole for all these dogs. Who live in this Dog City, and he's the piano player in the bar. He's also kind of the narrator, but the it's just this kind of silly noir parody about a dog named Ace U, and there's a whole joke about his name being like a sneeze.
Mm-hmm.
Like Ace U coming back to town after being gone for a long time, and fighting this mobster dog bad guy. And it's like when I was 4 years old or 5 years old or however old I was when I saw this thing, I had no conception of what noir was.
Sure.
So I just thought it was this cool thing with a detective who was a dog. And in Copernicus Jones, my homage to Dog City is that Copernicus's investigative software is called Ace U investigative software.
You're discovering quickly, you know, I'm sure you've picked this up, that, you know, people, creators like to put in all their personal inside jokes that, unless without real explanation or the deep, fans will only find it.
Yeah. Maybe that's an Easter egg. Maybe that's a joke only for myself. I don't really care.
Right.
But parody is, I was aware of noir parodies so much longer before I had any idea who Dashiell Hammett was,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it was only when I was in my late teens, mid to late teens, that I started watching, you know, The Maltese Falcon and The Big Sleep and Double Indemnity and figured out what the real noir of the 30s and 40s was.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have such an investment in noir parody. It really is was my gateway into the genre. I kind of wanted to do something that was an homage to that.
Like, so and, a parody of a parody. Yeah.
An homage to parody. Yes.
Right.
And at the same time, you know, we talked about, you mentioned that I used to write for Cracked occasionally. Before I wrote for Cracked, I was a frequent contributor to this message board that was part of the website for a comedy writer, humor writer. He now works for Valve. He co-wrote one of the Portal games named Jay Pinkerton. And one of the things we used to do on Jay Pinkerton's message board were these remixed comics, where we would take comic panels, rearrange them, put new captions and word balloons in them, and try to make them really funny.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I used to do all the time in those Photoshop contests was come up with a funny name and a funny occupation for the lead character. like give it a title that was funny name, colon, funny occupation.
Mm-hmm. Got it.
And
like
I would just
Copernicus Jones, robot detective.
Exactly. That is right. Where that came from. That is awesome. Where that whole idea came from. Like I was coming up with stuff like Abber Ab Dabber Town Crier.
And I would buy that.
And just like trying to come up with funny name, colon, funny occupation for all these comics. And it's one point or another, I never made a comic out of it because I don't think we had any Remix comics that involved too many robots. But one of the names that I was like, I'm going to use this at some point, was Copernicus Jones, Robot Detective. And that one just like burrowed into my head and stuck there for years. And for a long time, it was just a name and an occupation in my head.
Cool. So not necessarily a visual and not necessarily a story as well.
No, it was just a title. And cool. And only when I started thinking about like marrying something to this idea of noir parody did I say, oh, this goes together, and like sit down and write a script. And as I sat down and started writing a script, I was trying to make it like the funniest thing I could make it, like broad parody. Mm-hmm. And maybe by the second or third page, I was like, no, no, wait, I love noir. This can't be full on parody. This has to be more of a love letter. Also, yeah. I think I have a kind of a good mystery idea. Mm-hmm. And so from there, it became this other thing.
Doesn't that adds to the longevity of a story though, right? Like if you're going just for the joke, that seems pretty finite, you know, or it's got to be a different setting almost every time. And then you don't really have a through line in some ways. When you have your story laid out and you intermix humor into it, that seems like a much more sustainable way of writing a series too.
Well, I became a lot more focused on plot. And I think as far as sustainability goes, that is 100% accurate. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah.
Like plot, if you don't have a lot of flexibility to come up with new plots, and my plan for Copernicus Jones is to make it very, almost kind of episodic.
Sure.
Like it doesn't really, it's not going to really matter where the story arcs occur. Uh-huh. As it goes, the only one that's going to kind of matter time-wise is eventually I'm going to tell the story of why he went from being a cop to a private eye.
Mm-hmm.
And why he started putting on the trench coat and the hat. Because robots wearing clothes, unless it's like occupational, like a police hat, not really a thing that happens.
Yeah, you kind of allude to that even in the first two issues.
Yeah, there's not really, like, Copernicus has something weird going on in his head.
Mm-hmm.
Where he thinks he's, or in his circuitry, where he thinks that he's almost playing a role of a private eye. But like back to the stuff about plot, I just kind of decided like, oh wait, there's actually a lot of storytelling potential with this character, and if I just use him for jokes or just kind of go like say, okay, here's my noir parody, I really only have one story to tell with that.
Mm-hmm.
If I use him to tell what are interesting noir plots to me, or noir stories that have a twist on them because there are robots that exist in the world, then I have kind of infinite potential.
Well, it's like, a more sophisticated approach to embracing both of those genres anyway. I think the subtlety is what sells this for me. And much of that has to do with my personal taste. But generally, I like smarter parody. And I think that you have to be smarter if you're going to do it in a more subtle way. And so I think I really enjoyed the first two issues. I was skeptical because I am. And then I'm like, hey, this is the tone of this is so spot on. It was very enjoyable. So
luckily I figured out the tone very early.
Yeah.
And after maybe a page or two of trying to go a little bigger with the
mm-hmm.
humor,
mm-hmm.
I could go back and easily scale it back. But what I feel like where I hit the tone, the like kind of, and it all just kind of congealed for me, was when I described the businessman who is kind of the trigger for this case becoming bigger than it than Copernicus thought it was going to be.
Right.
The businessman who gets thrown out of a window in the first issue, mm-hmm. spoiler alert. when I described him as being his company making screws and bolts
yes.
and oil
medical
and all
equipment.
Kinds of other medical supplies.
Oh God, I loved it. I laughed out loud at that. That was fantastic.
That was when my brain was just like, this is it.
Yeah. Like, I think that was the point I texted Aaron actually and said something very eloquent like Copernicus Jones is fucking hilarious or something like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I that's very very kind. I appreciate that.
You should put that. Like, there's your pull quote.
My pull quote. Right. Yeah. When we publish a trade.
Yep.
On the front.
Yeah. Right there.
I don't know if we can get an F-bomb on the cover.
I mean, you just have to you polybag it. That way people have to buy two anyway.
There you go.
Then it's an homage to an entirely different genre right there. So
I'll polybag in a Death of Superman polybag.
Yes, with the armband.
Yeah. it's that straight-facedness.
Yes.
That just immediately made me go, okay, I think I'm going in the right direction with this. And it's that tone that I've tried to keep persistent throughout. Although I will say, it does get, as it progresses and sort of what is actually going on becomes clear, it gets a little more serious. It gets slightly more like actual noir, by maybe the fourth or fifth issue of the arc, but I never try to make the tone too dark or make it like too severe. That said, it is a noir story, and noir stories tend to have pretty dark endings. So, again, it's a balance to strike, and I hope I maintain it. But I also want it to have like impact by the time you get to. Mm-hmm. The sixth issue, like this first arc is six issues. Walking that tightrope has been kind of really interesting and also kind of terrifying.
Well, can we talk about another type of balance? Because we actually touched on this a bit with Chris, but I didn't get the chance to put him on the spot nearly as much. So I'm going to project onto you. I personally think thanks. I think the division between comics creation and comics journalism is really fascinating, mostly because I think that unlike a lot of other creative fields, the perception and the reality are pretty different. I think that readers and fans expect and assume a certain amount of objectivity, but there are many comics journalists who also make comics, and some of the best comics analysis out there is being done by fellow creators. So I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about how you balance that personally. And why do you think the comics industry is relatively unique in that regard?
I think it's so small is the main thing. Mm. Comics isn't big enough, I think, it's complex. I listened to you talking to Chris about this topic as well, and Chris, I think, very very kind of clearly stated that he thinks that being a journalist has helped him as a writer.
Mm-hmm. Do you agree?
I kind of fall in a different place on that, but I think it's because Chris and I kind of do different things as mm-hmm. far as comics journalism is concerned. Chris is very, very big on the analysis side of things and kind of a lot of what he writes is about kind of getting into the internal workings of a story.
Right.
And in that regard, I don't think that could do anything but help you write comics better. I write reviews and that sort of thing, but it's the lion's share of what I do when I write for Comics Alliance is news and then kind of op-ed pieces about the comics industry.
Right.
And that is a really difficult balance to strike. Just as someone like me who kind of came up wanting to really get involved in journalism, and I went to journalism school. I it's what I do as a day job. Not anything comics related, but but just, you know, as day to day, I'm an editor. So I worry a lot about conflict of interest. And so, you know, anything about monkey brain, I'm not going to do at this point. Like, or I'd even be hesitant to write a piece on Comics Alliance about Chris Robertson, just because I have a professional working relationship with him now, with Copernicus Jones. So I think eventually, you know, if and when I become more involved and invested in being a comics creator, eventually it's going to get to the point where comics journalism is an impossibility. I'm going to have too many personal connections and just be too invested in it myself to look at it from an objective point of view, or not have very clear biases that work their way into what I write as analysis. Now, I think there are a lot of comics journalists who don't ever think about any of that.
I think so too. Which is why it's really interesting to hear you articulate it like that, because I think that you are in the minority, at least in the minority of individuals who have maybe a foot on both sides, who have been outspoken about their feelings of those dual roles.
Yeah. Well, I feel bad naming names, so I won't. But
yeah, you don't have to. It's fine.
But, you know, I have read pieces of comics journalism where someone will talk about, you know, some overarching issue going on in the comics world, like convention of harassment or something like that. And they'll say, my friend, this person, who is a person in the comics industry, or my dear friend, whoever, and no op-ed piece or analysis piece or trend piece about the industry someone covers as a journalist should ever call anybody a friend. They're not your friends.
Right.
But Matt, sources. Do you think that that's because your background is in journalism for real, as opposed to, I mean, let's be honest, a lot of comics journalists come at it not as journalists, but as you know, they come at it from the comics perspective, not from a journalistic perspective. I'm not devaluing the analysis that they're offering. I'm just saying that that is the objectivity and the conflict of interest argument that you're putting forth as valid, which I agree with, is something that belongs very strongly in like the journalism corner. That's a matter of journalistic integrity that doesn't necessarily translate when you're writing about an industry as an industry insider.
I don't think that's specific necessarily to comics. I think it's the result of the democratizing influence of the internet.
Okay, sure. Yeah.
Because anybody can be a comics journalist now.
Right.
Right. I mean, two people who meet on Twitter can start a podcast and, you know.
Exactly. I think podcasts are a little bit of a different animal. Unless you're presenting your podcast as a news podcast. I think a podcast like War Rocket Ajax, I don't consider to be newsy.
Yeah.
It's really something where Chris and I sit down in front of a couple of microphones and we talk to comics creators like they're our friends. And we may ask them about their projects and stuff, but we're not hiding that a lot of what we're letting people say on the show is promotional. We're not hiding that some of these people we know and we call them our friends. We're not presenting it as you know, full on comics analysis in a news setting. So I think there's a fuzzy dividing line there, but there is a dividing line.
You still have to run into, or maybe Chris runs into this more than you, but you know, like you people you have on the show who are your friends, you still will have, you probably have to get asked time to time as a reviewer or you know, a writer to write about a project that they're working on too, right? Or do you have to then draw lines of like, I, you know, say Matt Fraction or something like that? Do you have to draw a line at Matt's work and say, we know him, I know him too well to get, you know, to analyze his work for a
site? It's getting there. I don't know if it's there yet. I think I can remove myself enough from a review to objectively review a Matt Fraction comic.
Hmm. But like you said, not Chris Robertson and not anything from Monkey Brain. And like, I think that makes sense, that would be the line that you would have already drawn for yourself.
I think there's a very clear line when you already have a professional relationship.
Yep. Yeah.
When it comes to personal relationships, there's just gotta be this gut feeling of it doesn't feel right anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with say Matt Fraction, I very much enjoy talking to him on the podcast. You know, I exchange emails with him occasionally, and if I'm at a con that he's at, we'll talk for a long time, or we might, you know, have a meal together. But I'm not like on a friendly basis with him, talking to him every day.
Mm-hmm.
Like I wouldn't say we're close friends, but when we are around each other, we're friendly. When we talk on the podcast, we try to make hilarious comedy.
Mm-hmm.
So it's getting to the point. It could have, like, if that relationship got any closer, I would eventually reach a point where I say, okay, I can't review his comics anymore, because it's just we are absolutely definitely friends now. But it's not to that point. It's more of a gut thing.
Yeah.
When you establish a professional relationship, it's got to end right then.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Like where, okay, now I'm working, writing a book with him.
Yeah. But to the topic of how comics are different, and I said like the democratizing influence of the internet certainly has an effect on, I don't know, quote unquote, citizen journalism.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The barrier to entry is pretty low now.
And you can be a blogger who doesn't necessarily work for CBR or Comics Alliance or Newsarama or whoever, and get a press pass to a con.
Yeah.
And that's fine. But there's, you know, that makes the ethics barrier or the level of ethics a real moving target.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on, like, there was a controversy a few weeks ago about Bleeding Cool, some Bleeding Cool reporters at conventions overhearing conversations and then reporting those conversations as interviews or quoting them in a story.
Right.
That is the worst thing on earth to me, as far as journalism is concerned.
But again, like, I think that's because you're a journalist, and I.
Well, but that gets to my point of there are people. I think people are serving several different masters.
Okay.
In terms of their shifting ethics.
Sure.
Like, you know, you have people like me and I would say a lot of comics journalists who have an eye on getting into comics as a creator.
Mm-hmm.
And there are plenty of examples of people who did get into comics as a creator based on sort of journalistic things dating even back to the 70s with zines.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that aspect of it, which kind of makes for shaky territory. But at the same time, you also have these, I guess you would call them TMZ elements, tabloid elements, who aren't necessarily angling for that, like, I want to make friends and get into the industry aspect of it, as much as I want to publish this thing that's juicy, that's going to get the most hits.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it's kind of coming from two sides.
But the industry also uses, like, you know, I think Bleeding Cool is the good example of that. You see pieces on there that are obviously beneficial to whatever the company or the creator that's putting it out there. You know, it's a gossip piece or a rumor piece to generate buzz. You know, it's
sure.
I think you either have to completely divest yourself from it, then you can cast, you know, judgment on it, or you understand, I guess it's a double-edged sword. I don't find it to be particularly a way that news should be fed, but it seems like that's what, like, the de-evolvement of the journalistic industry, especially in comics, has kind of gone. But it's probably true for most news in a lot of ways.
I've never encountered one of the big differences in comics for me is this notion of access and how even the slightest criticism a lot of times can lead to reduced access. Mm-hmm. or just not printing a press, like not publishing a press release as is, mm-hmm. as an article, which is gross to me. Mm-hmm. But like every other journalistic endeavor I've ever been a part of, there's kind of been an understanding of like, okay, our newspaper or our website or whatever might run an editorial that says what the county government did was reprehensible and abhorrent, and they should be voted out of office. But you're not going to bar me from coming back into, a county government meeting.
Yeah.
Right.
Based on that.
Right.
In comics, the idea of access, like everybody's afraid to say, to criticize, I don't know, for example, DC, for moving its offices west, or to question, you know, what's going to happen to those employees in New York, or even when DC says, you know, we're going to start publishing 3 weekly books all concurrently, mm-hmm. and just say like, isn't that crazy? nobody wants to ask that question because they're afraid if they ask that question to Dan DiDio, then Dan DiDio is never going to talk to them again.
Yeah. And he can, because there's, a 1,000 other people who will say, oh, great idea, we can't wait for it.
Exactly. And it's this weird cannibalizing tiny community.
Yeah.
Where people are trying to sort of stay on everyone's good side so they can write Batman one day. Mm-hmm. but that leads to never following up a question.
Yeah.
And I've sort of tried to get away from that somewhat in my interviews and just the stuff I write. I try to write thought-provoking stuff about, you know, real issues. And maybe I've hurt myself in some ways doing that as a creator, but the journalist in me just has to say, like, you got to ask these follow-up questions. you got to find out what's really going on and question what, you know, on its face seems like a very strange decision. So I think I've probably made things way more confusing than they were, but they are really confusing.
Yeah.
So I
find it really interesting just to sort of watch as each new controversy pops up and the bubble around it and the reaction around it, and then it dies down again, and to see how certain names appear over and over again and certain trends or patterns are revisited. And so I think it's really intriguing because the industry is so small. But knowing your background outside of the industry as a journalist, and then kind of within it in both camps as a creator now and as a writer about the industry as a whole, I just think that your perspective is relatively valid. So thank you for answering that.
Thank you. And to not totally bash bloggers who just write for no pay and then go out there, you know, and go cover cons and stuff like that. There are the bloggers who seem to be in it to get something out of it. And then there are the bloggers. I think the democratizing influence of the internet has had very positive effects too, mm-hmm. because without that, we wouldn't have these blogs that say, here are the number of female creators that Marvel has right now. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Here's the number of female artists. Here's the number of artists of color. That stuff almost entirely comes from Tumblr and then bloggers who are just interested in this diversity issue in a way that has never really been discussed before.
By the more mainstream media.
Yeah.
You mean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I also think that the democratization results in a great sharing of the love. Like, the word of mouth in a positive way is absolutely something that can't be discounted. So sure. The conversations that happen with fans online because they really love comics, is also something that doesn't have to be about news. It doesn't have to be about covering issues. It can just be about, this was great and here's why, and you like this kind of stuff too, you should try it. I think there's a place for that also. I'm not putting it at the same level as like hard-hitting news in terms of impact on the industry, but maybe it does actually have an impact on the bottom line in terms of bringing in like new readers or encouraging readers in some regard to expand out into another book or another creator that they're not familiar with.
It certainly opens up communities in a way that going to your local comic shop may not.
Right.
Mm-hmm. 'Cause you know, the feel of a local comic shop, you know, your local comic shop may not be in line with the taste you have,
mm-hmm.
but you can find a community that shares that taste online somewhere.
Right.
I'm sorry. Internet. That was a long period of me not being funny. I'm sorry, everybody.
Oh, it's cool. It's cool.
Greatest apologies.
That's okay. I'm just going to take one of these reams of Bitcoin here. I'm just going to set it to the side.
My Bitcoin wealth has declined.
You can earn it back. There's still some time.
Oh, good. I feel like one of those waiters at a restaurant where the people, like the customer just puts a stack of quarters on the table when they sit down.
Right.
And then when they mess up, they just take a quarter away.
Huh, that's a good idea.
That's not really a thing, is it?
I've heard people doing that, yes.
Oh.
Wow. Well, I didn't bring any quarters with me. You don't have to worry about it.
Bitcoins only.
Bitcoins only. I'm just going to bring reams of paper with me from now on when I go out to eat. Well, let's talk about something a little less, I don't know, heavy, I guess.
Sorry.
That's all right. We have our roles to play. So let's talk about comics, your love of comics, and why. Like, can we talk about the past, like your influences? What cemented comics with you at an early age?
It really comes down to my brother. Mm. My brother is about a little more than eight years older than me.
Okay.
So when I was very young, it's a pretty big gap. And all I ever wanted to do when I was 3-4 years old was be him.
Mm-hmm.
And this was in the early 90s. So it was the big comics boom of that period. And he was really into them. And
Matt, how old are you?
I am 30.
Okay. I can edit that out if you don't want me to share that with the internet.
People know. But he was really into Batman at the time. He, like everybody else, he bought that X-Men number one, that Jim Lee X-Men number one.
He only bought one copy? He didn't get all the variants and everything?
He may have had more than one. I can't remember. In all my many times secretly going into his room and looking through his comics, I don't remember how many he had. He definitely bought Death of Superman. He bought all the big events, and then he got really into early Image.
Yeah.
He got all those early Image books. And then he was into some like kind of weird smaller press books that at the time were super strange to me, but also really cool. Like I remember him getting Nexus.
Oh yeah.
He was really into a book called The Badger.
Uh-huh. Sure. The Image run of that, or the prior Comico that put that out or something?
I think he maybe originally found out about it from Image,
mm-hmm.
and then he went back and tried and found that Comico stuff.
Uh-huh.
But you know, it was all that kind of thing that he was into, and I was just like, well, obviously I have to be into comics like him. But what do I like that's comics? Or there might be comics of. I clearly liked Batman, so I would go to the comic shop and buy Batman stuff.
'90s Batman, because that's for a little kid. That's dark stuff.
I very clearly remember going and buying an issue of Suicide Squad.
Oh, really?
That had Batman on the cover, and I bought it strictly because it had Batman on the cover.
Mm-hmm.
And when 5-year-old me trying to read this Suicide Squad issue and just not getting it. I just never understood it.
Mm-hmm.
But I tried to read it at least 25 times. I loved Superman. I loved the Christopher Reeve Superman movies. My love of Superman 3 is very well documented.
Mm-hmm.
And I bought several Superman comics, and my parents and family would buy me Superman comics, put them in my stockings at Christmas. I very clearly remember having the Armageddon 2001 annual where Superman becomes the president.
I'm pretty sure I have that somewhere in one of my long boxes.
Reading that a bunch. I got a lot of cartoon books. I got Ghostbusters comics. I got Alf comics. I got Zelda and Mario comics during that short-lived Valiant Nintendo comics thing that was going on. So I had that period when I was very young, when I was reading everything I could because my brother was into it. And then eventually my brother went to college or kind of got out of it, maybe even in late high school.
I'm curious, did he transition to like playing Magic the Gathering? Because that was my arc. I ditched comics for collectible card games.
He got really, really into like music stuff. So he started buying guitars and listening to some of that 90s, not quite hair metal, maybe like progressive rock kind of stuff.
That's a better road to take in when you go off to college than sitting in a dark room playing Magic the Gathering or something. So probably a smart move on his part.
He got really into playing guitar.
So, does he still read comics?
Some. I think he mostly kind of vicariously finds out about comics through me.
Got it.
Role just reversal. Well, he was really into wrestling when he was young too, and I got into wrestling through that. And I, in both cases, I'm the one who stuck with it.
Huh. Nice. After you are dedicated.
I am. I'm the committal one between the two of us. But I kind of laid off wrestling for a while and then got back into it. But like last time I saw my brother, or maybe the time before that, sometime when we were meeting back at my parents' house, he started asking me about Chikara Pro Wrestling. And I was like, oh, let me tell you all about it. And I was like going on the internet and showing him stuff. Anyway, so he kind of fell out of it. And at that same time, when I was in elementary school, I kind of did what he did and fell out of it too. And it was only when I was maybe middle school age and the Spider-Man cartoon was suddenly really big. The X-Men cartoon was pretty big. But I really developed this passionate feelings about Spider-Man. So I would actually go to the grocery store with my mom, because my mom taught at the middle school where I went to school. So after school, she would go buy groceries. I'd go to the grocery store with her, and I'd immediately go to the magazine section of the grocery store and read magazines. There were also comics in that magazine section of the grocery store. It was not that long ago that that happened.
Yeah.
Right.
it was all Marvel stuff. They didn't have any DC stuff at the grocery store, only Marvel.
Oh.
And so I just started buying up Spider-Man books. And occasionally I'd look through the X-Men books and other things. I got into some weird 90s comics by virtue of the fact that the grocery store only had Marvel books and only had the Marvel books they had. That's how I ended up reading Maverick.
Yeah.
But I would religiously buy the Spider-Man books there. And that led me into going back to my local comic shop, which I hadn't been to in a long time. And then just the amount of books I was reading just got bigger and bigger and bigger. And it never stopped after that. So that was when I was maybe 13. That, like, I had a period of maybe 6 years where I just didn't do anything. And then I came back to it initially through Spider-Man. And then...
Well, it's kind of interesting. Like, as bad as the comics are at that time, they're probably perfect for, like a 11, 12, 13-year-old.
I still have very, very fond memories of just after the Clone Saga Spider-Man.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of got back into it right at the tail end of the Clone Saga, and I didn't end up catching up on all that stuff, much to my chagrin.
but if you had read that as an 11 or 12 year old, that's fine. I bet it would be perfect.
Yeah.
Because you're not really looking at it with a critical eye.
Right. It's certainly not the same reaction I would have to something like that now.
Right.
But at the time, even now, I still kind of look back really fondly on those Spider-Man stories, particularly in Spectacular Spider-Man. This is a very forgotten period of Spectacular Spider-Man. When J.M. DeMatteis was writing it and Luke Ross was doing the art. And there was a big storyline with Kraven. There was a big storyline with Jack-O-Lantern. Mm-hmm. There's a lot going on with Chameleon in that book at that time. Mm-hmm. I just loved it. It hooked me so perfectly right back into it. And, that was also around the time, Heroes Reborn was kind of going on then. But it was also, I got back into all those books as that was winding down. And I don't think I could have had a better reintroduction to the Avengers and Iron Man and the Fantastic Four and Captain America than the Heroes Reborn, the Return books, mm-hmm. which were Mark Waid and Kurt Busiek.
Those are great.
I can't remember. I'm drawing a blank on who came back on Fantastic Four right after that. I want to say it was Scott Lobdell.
I don't know. See, that's an era that for me, that's sort of a blank spot that I'm going back and filling in. Cause I'm 36. So I was, after Death of Superman and Nightfall and that sort of stuff, that's where I started winding out of comics and didn't really come back to them until about 5 years ago.
Yeah. There's a section of comics right there around 96, 97 after the bottom fell out.
Mm-hmm.
That where after everyone, so many people who had quit reading after the big 90s boom, that are some great comics. There's a little window of great comics nobody read.
Yeah.
Right in there. And that's when the Amalgam stuff is coming out too, and that stuff's great. The stuff that nobody was reading was what pulled me back into comics.
I think it took a while for people to discover that comics had become good again.
Yeah, that's very true.
Is there anything that you've read recently that you think that more people should be paying attention to? Or, I don't know, something that is on your radar that's coming out that you want to give a shout out to?
Something that might be, that people might be sleeping on?
Yeah.
Maybe. I think maybe something that you're aware of that more people should be, but that... not anything sort of secret times here, but just outside of the big two or even Image.
And don't say Cobra because people can't buy it yet.
Well, we've talked about that already.
I feel like everybody's talked up Cobra already. I think Cobra is the book that everybody wants but can't have.
Right. So it's the easy go-to, you should really read that.
I'm lucky enough to live in a place where I can just, hop on a train, go to a comic shop, and they have pretty much every issue of Cobra on a shelf. But I know a lot of people don't have that luxury. But anyway, what I would say would be something that actually is an Image, a couple of Image books. I feel like there are a couple different tiers of Image.
Sure.
There's the Image, there's the established creators Image.
Mm-hmm.
Those books that kind of get bought a lot more or get a lot more attention because people know
there's a name attached to it,
from Marvel and DC. And then there's the Image books where it's just okay, these are the creators that are just kind of getting their start at Image. Then they're going to go to Marvel and DC for a while. Then they're going to come back to Image and they're going to be in that tier, that top tier.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of the way the Image works now. And there's some that are in that tier of the creators trying to get started that I think are really good. There is a book called Ghosted by Joshua Williamson.
Yeah, we talked to Josh a couple weeks ago.
That I think is really great. It's a really interesting twist on the classic haunted house story. But with full of scoundrels, every character is a scoundrel. That is 100, that is a Matt Wilson loves this book already concept. because I love scoundrel characters in everything. Like, scoundrels are always my favorite characters.
Do you like them to be redeemed, or do you like them to retain their kind of that sort of evil side, you know, and maybe not learn from their mistakes?
I really like them to always be ineffective, because and like, ineffective scoundrels never learn their lesson because they're never effective enough for anybody to tell them to change.
Like C-level supervillains.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And so, I mean, Ghosted's characters are not that ineffective. I still love the scoundrels, though. But like, the kind of quintessential scoundrel for me is just somebody who is just sniveling and will suck up to anybody, but they'll also stab you in the back in a second. They just want to do whatever they want to get what they want. Arnold Rimmer from Red Dwarf is like quintessential scoundrel. So Ghosted is really good. And then another one that is not actually an Image book. It's a Dark Horse book, but that I really liked. And I don't know if a lot of people read it. I think it's out in trade now. It was a mini series, called Dream Thief by Jai Nitz.
Yes.
And I'm drawing a blank on the artist's name, but, the art has a kind of a very Sean Phillips-y. Doug Smallwood. Yeah. And that's actually his first comics work published. And it's great. It looks so good. I'm comparing it to Sean Phillips, but it's definitely got its own look and flair to it. It's got these really cool panel designs. Like, there's a panel in the first issue that's just a question mark.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the panel is in the shape of a question mark. It's full of, like, little interesting, innovative ideas like that.
Yeah, that was a great miniseries.
Yeah, and we talked about that in the fall, I think before the miniseries ended.
Yeah.
But we didn't revisit it afterwards.
Yeah, I think, by the end of it, it was just really nicely done.
Mm-hmm.
And it's another, you know, comic spin on the crime genre. Mm-hmm. It's sort of supernatural crime.
Right.
Which is cool. Like, I love so much that comics... And Copernicus Jones does this, you know, comics is one of the only media where you can kind of just like throw ingredients into a bowl and just see what happens, like genre ingredients.
Mm-hmm.
And just say like, okay, I'm putting crime in there. I'm putting ghosts in there. Dash of robots. Let's see how this comes out.
Right.
Always with the dash of robots, I think.
Yeah. And like,
oh wait, are robots the new zombies? Did we just figure something out here?
Oh, that's exciting.
Boy,
I'm tired of reading about comics.
Right. You're banking on it.
My wallet is banking on it.
Mm-hmm.
But it, like, really though, like, so much has been written, so much digital ink has been spilled about comics needing to get away from superheroes or like comics not just being superheroes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're proving that, including myself in that is probably wrong. Comics is proving that, with these conceptual comics, like even like one of the most popular new Image books, Sex Criminals, is doing that because it's a romantic comedy, kind of a dirty romantic comedy mixed with some sci-fi stuff.
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah, and superpowers though. Yeah, I mean, they're superpowers, but I wouldn't call them superheroes.
Yeah.
Not yet, at least.
I love this new trend of just genre mix and match.
Mm-hmm.
That's going on. It's really encouraging.
I agree with all that. I think the independent space couldn't be more healthy or varied and with so much, you know, options. I still personally, I want the big two to thrive as well, if that makes sense. Like, you know, I think Marvel's doing a really good job, and I'm primarily an independent reader, but I read a ton of Marvel, and DC not so much, but I want DC to be great too. I want them all to be great because I think they're all outlets for creators in their own ways, you know, like
it's a case of the tide rising, you know, rising tide lifts all ships,
yeah,
kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah.
What I have a question though for DC, because I think you're fairly vocal of the criticism of it and some of your feelings, at least, you know, when you're talking on War Rocket Ajax.
We play it up a lot for humor's sake.
Yeah. Sure, yeah. I mean, it's for entertainment. But I want to hear something positive about DC. What's your favorite DC book right now?
My favorite ongoing DC book, mm-hmm. is Wonder Woman. Yeah. And I know it's changing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, that's a bittersweet answer, I guess, after this week, huh?
I do think DC has little snippets and snatches of brilliance. And if it can capture that, it can do really well. Like a book that I don't think a lot of people paid attention to that was exactly what DC should be doing was the Lois Lane one-shot that came out a few weeks ago.
Hmm.
It's a very classic story set in a superhero universe that doesn't focus on a superhero. It's a book all about Lois Lane getting involved in an investigation and then getting over her head and maybe having to seek out a little help to deal with it, but also kind of by the power of her will and perseverance saying, I'm going to change this and make it better.
Mm-hmm.
Or
a twist
find out
on a damsel in distress kind of thing. I didn't read it. I don't read any DC regularly. I catch it after the fact, but.
Well, Lois isn't really distressed at all, or a damsel in distress at all. If there's a damsel in distress, it is her sister, Lucy.
Okay. Got it.
It's basically Lois trying to figure out what's going on with Lucy, investigating a drug ring, and then finding out it's much bigger than anything she kind of expected at the beginning.
Okay.
But you know, still saying, I'm going to figure out what's going on and help you, Lucy. And even when she talks to Superman in the book, which happens, you know, in a few panels, it's never like, hey, Superman, I really, really need your help. It's more about like, all right, Superman's here. I know you exist. I need you to have my back.
Mm-hmm.
But not like, but also like never doubting her capability or abilities.
That's refreshing.
It's also interesting too, because that's Marguerite Bennett is, I think, her last name. Like, she's pretty brand new to comics too. So it's kind of cool to see that she has a fresh, you know, perspective.
I think she did a great job with this book. It's got giant monsters in it.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
What about robots, though? Does it have robots?
No, I don't recall all that many robots. But it's basically about a drug that you can take, or that people take, and then the first animal they come into contact with kind of binds with their DNA,
mm-hmm.
and then they become a monster, like an animal monster. And some of the animal, like some of the monsters in this thing, are so crazy. Like there are like triceratops running around in this thing. And I love that. It's like you can't do that anything stuff that crazy anywhere but in somewhere like the DC universe.
Right, and where you look at it and you go like, "That's funny," but it doesn't break the wall of the world, I guess.
Yeah, I think what DC should do, and I think this book actually does it. Like, they don't have to abandon the idea of quote unquote adult storytelling or like having like serious real stories. But embrace being a comic book company that has goofy stuff right. in your comic book universe. and for so long, so much of DC's problem, even before the New 52, has just felt like they're ashamed of comics.
Yeah. Yeah, that they're like a little bit embarrassed that's their legacy, and instead of embracing it. I totally agree. And that's like me as a not particularly well-read DC reader at all.
Like, comics don't have to have people's arms constantly being cut off to be considered, I don't know, viable and serious.
Mm-hmm.
You can have monster people as long as it's in the context of, you know, a sort of a complex character-driven story.
Yeah.
I think there are a few writers that are taking DC in a much better direction as far as that goes. Like, to name a couple other books that I think are really kind of on the right track, Action Comics, mm-hmm. by Greg Pak and Aaron Cooter is really, really great. And then Aquaman, I think Jeff Parker is doing a really nice job since taking over Aquaman. You know, both of those books had first issues with their new writers where the hero fought a giant monster.
Yeah.
And if that's going to be a template for what DC is going to do with its characters, fantastic. Do it. We need more Superman fighting giant monsters and Aquaman dealing with giant monsters instead of Superman walking around and crying and like letting drug dealers burn to death.
I think that's a good quote for this interview.
Yes.
In comics, well, in general.
In life, I think. Mm-hmm. More giant monsters.
Less burning drug dealers.
Yes.
Okay, so this was awesome, but I am now going to ask you the most important question of the day, and then we're going to wrap it up. Are you ready?
I'm ready. I'm prepared.
How do you prefer your barbecue?
North Carolina, Western North Carolina style, sliced, not chopped, with vinegar-based sauce.
Oh, good job.
And preferably with hush puppies. And the ideal is that there is a pitcher of sweet tea on the table.
Just because I know that people are going to ask, what's a hush puppy in your definition?
A hush puppy is, well, it can vary somewhat. But a barbecue hush puppy is very different from a seafood hush puppy.
Right.
A seafood hush puppy is usually more round. A barbecue hush puppy is more elongated. Cornmeal based. There can be a little onion flavoring in it, but it doesn't need to have like big hunks of onion in there. deep fried, a little bit crispy, and then you're good to go.
Do you have a place in Chicago that you can actually get this?
No. I've tried. I've been searching. I actually had a short-lived blog about trying barbecue in Chicago.
Yeah.
And I just gave up on it because my search just yielded nothing. I've found a few places that have an okay pulled pork sandwich, but there's nothing even in the universe of North Carolina style barbecue here, sadly.
I was trying to think what a Eugene, Oregon barbecue option is, and it has a vegan option, you know, so you have your, it would be barbecue, it'd be grilled, you know, tofu, you have your chicken, I guess you could probably get french fries with it. I really need to explore that a little more, but
that doesn't sound all that different from my wife and I got married in Asheville, North Carolina. Uh-huh. And we had a local barbecue place cater our reception. And as if you needed to know that, and they had vegetarian options that we made available at our wedding. So, you can get that even at the North Carolina spots where we're all purists.
At a certain point, it's a vehicle for the sauce. I mean, let's be honest.
It's true. I think one of the big complaints about North Carolina barbecue, especially from Texans.
I could hear the vitriol in your voice.
Is that the meat is masked by the sauce. Like it's all the sauce is the whole show. And certainly some places do that, but it's really got to be, you know, a complementary relationship.
Sure.
Like,
but the sauce can make or break the good meat in a barbecue.
Yeah, bad sauce can be a deal breaker for sure.
Yep. Vinegar based for the win. Nice answer.
Well, I agree.
All right, I'll put the Bitcoins back on the stack here. You've earned them back.
Oh. Yes.
Well, thank you again, Matt, for joining us on the couch this week. Thanks everyone else for listening to another episode of Comics Therapy. Don't forget to pre-order your comics at your local shop or subscribe to them digitally. Show notes and other details are on our site, as always, on comicstherapy.com. We'll talk to you next week.